Let's talk technology now. Artificial intelligence back in the news. Fevzi Turkalp, the gadget detective, is here. Fevzi, how are you keeping?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm all right, Fevzi. I'm getting there. Good. Getting there very quickly. A lot of artificial intelligence news around, and of course we were the first to discuss this on this programme and the real and present dangers of the thing. I mean, I've got to say, and this is just my personal view, that in this period that I haven't been on air, I've been watching the stories as they've appeared about artificial intelligence, and it started to appear to me that artificial intelligence is going to be a really good thing, yes, in areas like medicine, where you can get artificially diagnosed. There are a number of specific areas. But it seems to me that in many areas of our lives, those who will benefit the most from artificial intelligence are those who have the most resources. In other words, they're the people who own the businesses, who have the wealth and those sorts of things. You know, they will reap the rewards of the economies of scale that you can get from artificial intelligence. And the rest of us will be, you know, even further in the back rows, it seems to me. I don't know what you think about that, but it seems to me that we have, before we talk about specific news stories, there's a whole social impact that we need to start looking at here that I just don't think we are.
I think you're right. There's definitely the potential for the rich to get richer and the poor to be not only poorer, but also disenfranchised without rights, because these sorts of technologies not only can displace our jobs, but they can also be extremely intrusive. And at the moment, this technology is in the hands of relatively few organizations and governments. And it is a worry, because there really hasn't been much thought that's gone into this and what sort of oversight we can have, how we can limit it and try to guide it into something that's going to be useful for all of us. And that's you know, if you think of the printing press, one of the things about the printing press is that it was seen as democratizing, you know, that suddenly information was widely available. In the early days of the internet, I think, could be characterized in that way as well. However, I think with this, it's very different. I think control will pass to organizations. The cost of labor in many jobs will go to near zero. And it's going to be very hard for people to get along unless we create a whole new economic model based around universal basic income or another solution.
And I know that, you know, our government has 1,000 other things to think about, and an election on the horizon in about a year from now. But this is something that is proceeding at a rate of knots. The speed of it, it's almost exponential. And I think some of those people who we've elected to power need to get explaining to us what this is going to mean and how they are going to regulate it. It's all very nice for those people who sit in Westminster to say, let's take a light touch with all of this. They won't be in power, possibly, when all of this comes to fruition. And, you know, 10 years from now, they'll be doing other things. They will be, you know, reaping the rewards of their public service, perhaps. Who knows? You know, we need to be giving consideration to this, and we need to be putting limits on it where limits are required, it seems to me. I'm sorry I'm going off on one here, but I've had plenty of time to think about it. We need to be looking at the regulatory framework and to say that we are taking a light touch with all of this, and, you know, we're going to build business for Britain and all of that stuff misses the point, I think. And I think some of those people need to start thinking about it along with everything else they've got to think about, is my view.
Yeah, no, that's right. And you can contrast this to what's happening in the European Union. So the European Union is increasingly regulating this space. It's building on GDPR, which became a model for privacy. Even, you know, the United States is picking up some of GDPR, whereas we are dumping GDPR. This is the privacy regulations. So whilst we're busy trying to work out what we want to put in place of all the regulations and the rules that we're setting a bonfire to, European Union is pushing ahead. And for example, live face recognition by the police is one area where it's going to be outlawed.
Indeed, and that's been in the news this week. Computer Weekly, one of many organs that ran the story, says UK Policing Minister Chris Philp is pressing for facial recognition technology to be rolled out by police forces across England and Wales, and will likely push to integrate the tech with police body-worn video cameras. Now, I can see a lot of upsides about that, but I can also envision one or two downsides. Have we thought enough about this?
I think the government, what we're seeing is now that the UK government is free of European regulation, or at least is in a position to be free of it, It's definitely going for a softer touch. So it doesn't want any particular oversight of this. It doesn't want a stronger framework to say, okay, if we do this, how are we going to regulate it? How are we going to make sure it's not abused? How are we going to make sure that these powers are proportionate? Because clearly there can be great benefits from live facial recognition for police. But don't forget, if the police have got the ability to just walk along the street and just recognize everyone and pull up their full history, that's the equivalent of being of an individual having to hand over their identity card. So we say, well, we don't have to have identity cards. This is far more intrusive than an identity card. It's a bit like, you know, preparing, you know, hand over your papers in the Second World War. We just need to have a conversation about this as a society to say, what sort of society do we want to live in? Which freedoms are we willing to trade in return for which benefits? And you know, law enforcement will always try to get as many powers as it can. And it's not for law enforcement to regulate itself. It's for government and society to, you know, policing by consent. Do we want to live in a society where you can be recognized everywhere you walk? I mean, we already have it in our vehicles with automatic number plate recognition. Do we want that when you're on foot as well? Do we literally want there to be no... It's not privacy. People can't have an expectation of privacy in public. But if you go outside your door, do you want to be in a position where the police and local authorities and others can just recognise you and pull up your details? You know,
99.99 recurring percent of us, I don't know what the exact figure is, you know, I'm not guilty of any offence. We don't, you know, we don't contemplate crimes. We're not in the commission of crimes. So really, our downtime, our private time, really needs to be ours. But equally, I think this recognition technology could be a very good thing if a police officer is in a situation and needs to quickly... My father was a copper, as you know, Fawzi, needs to quickly identify somebody to know whether this is the person who we nabbed a week last Tuesday doing 120 miles through Solihull or whatever, 120 miles an hour through Solihull. So it's useful from that point of view. But the question that I would ask about it is, before, and my apologies for mispronouncing the name of the policing minister, Chris Philp, before we get rolling this out, can we guarantee the public that this is infallible technology? Because I don't think we can.
Well, it's far from infallible. And not so you've got people being incorrectly recognised, so you can get people arrested for the most heinous crimes. So people can be completely innocent. And by the way, the danger of that goes up considerably if your skin happens to be dark, because the recognition systems do not work as well on darker skin because the contrast is not as great. And therefore, it's more likely that people will be misrecognized if they're not white.
Which is a tremendous worry. And look, I'm not saying this is a bad thing. Rather like the whole AI topic, I just think we need to pause for thought. We need to assure the public that this stuff has a high degree of... You know, if it does have a high degree of reliability, and if it doesn't, why are we using it? But we also need to ask ourselves the question, are we going headlong into this without giving it the degree of thought that it probably needs? And, you know, sometimes I think we're on the verge of making decisions without thinking about the ramifications of those decisions. If you think about the way things are in China, they have the social credit system and all the rest of it, Fawzi, that you and I have talked about so many times before. You know, in China, they know everything that you do, you are pretty solidly tracked wherever you go. It's part of the system. You know, the technology is amazing that they've got, and it has upsides, but it has sizable downsides in limiting people's liberty. Is that the direction we want to go in? I wonder.
I think this government has... It's not that it's asleep at the wheel. It's that it's made a decision that it wants to push this technology through, and it wants not to have tight oversight of it. It doesn't, there's no measures to say that its use has to be proportionate. It could be left switched on all the time. So as soon as the camera comes on, the recognition system boots in. Well, maybe that's not right. Maybe when there's reasonable suspicion, just like you have to have reasonable suspicion for entering a private premises, right? You can't just walk in uninvited to any, you have to have a reason. So maybe there has to be that as well. And because there are rules about when you have to identify yourself to an enforcement officer as well. And, you know, this technology could be widely used. We've already seen local authorities using anti-terrorist technology and legislation to track us for our use of wheelie bins and this sort of nonsense. So you don't have any checks and balances. In the European Union, they are addressing this in a, I think, in the correct way, that they're actually making authorities make the case for proportionate use rather than giving them a blanket approval to do it. And I just worry that, and this is not to be party political about, you know, being in the European
Union. Which is always the danger, really, when you ask these questions, somebody's going to say to you, that Fevzi Turkalp you had on the show, is he anti-Brexit? I think he is. And, you know, a number of our viewers will take exception to that. But that's not what we're saying, I do not think.
We have the ability to make better law than the European Union if we want to. It's not that we shouldn't make our own law. We can do, but we should make it better than the club that we left. And when I say better, better for us, not for an intrusive state.
So when you look at the whole panoply of stories connected with artificial intelligence, and they're now hitting the media every day, you know, every day there's a company, I mean, BT this week, there was a report that BT, up to 55,000 jobs, according to the Daily Express, might be lost from the BT group by the end of the decade as the telecoms giant embraces AI for customer service and plans to overhaul the workforce. Now, that's just one tiny brick in the wall here, and this is moving at a tremendous pace. And I don't see our decision makers, and yes, we know that they've got to, you know, make Brexit work and get themselves re-elected if they can, and, you know, they're going to want to, and they'll be campaigning. But this is going to be the biggest defining issue of the next 50 years, the next 100 years, because it will have such an impact, as you and I have discussed so many times before. And I think I've only just kind of clicked on to how passionate I am about it. You know, this is going to be the defining issue of the next century. What role do we as human beings have? How much autonomy do we retain? How much freedom do we want? And some of that may be determined by technology. And there's a whole other issue here. If you don't lose your job because of it, if you don't find yourself arrested because of it, you may, if you don't embrace the technology that you're required to embrace, you may find yourself being disenfranchised. I had an email yesterday, day before, from a woman who was talking to me about because she cannot access certain events that she can only access and buy access to digitally. Because she can't do that, then she is effectively barred from enjoying those events. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a tiny example. You know, there are those, including myself, I don't, you know, I could do it. I just don't want to do it. Those of us who don't do online banking, if you want to expand that in the future of AI, where everything is, you know, is controlled by it, if you don't buy into it, you are left behind. What are we going to do with the people who might be a little older? And I'll be older by then. I'm getting older by the day. With those people who are just not quite on board the bus to the degree that everybody else is. Are we thinking about that?
So there's a lot there. The disenfranchisement at the moment is at the periphery, so people who are maybe older and less technically savvy, and those people are important. But the difference that's now happening is with the advance of AI, this is not just going to affect those people. It's going to affect almost everybody. So you mentioned 55,000 BT job losses.
Well, that's a newspaper figure, I think. But
that's a figure that BT have set in their target because their profits are not what their shareholders want it to be. Of that 55,000, they want 10,000 of that to be replaced by AI. And so all those customer service jobs inside BT, all those diagnostics jobs inside BT are going to go, and not just inside BT, everywhere. So that leaves us with a question. If AI-based technologies are going to displace a large number of jobs, and it's been estimated that that could be something like 300 million jobs worldwide, then how are we going to restructure our economy so that people can afford to eat and pay their bills? And how are people going to have money to buy the products and services of those now newly efficient
and
companies?
And you and I have been talking about that issue for several years now in podcasts that we've done together and conversations we've done together. I didn't expect, maybe you knew it was coming, I didn't think that we would be here on the cusp of this so soon. I mean, I thought this would be something that, you know, I'd probably have turned up my toes and be pushing up daisies somewhere before all of this happened, so I didn't have to worry about it. Actually, yeah, it's here.
Yeah, and it's kind of selfish of us to have had that thought, because even if it just affects the next generation, that's also serious in the future of humanity. It's kind of a serious thing. I think that most people didn't expect it to come as quickly as it appears to be coming. And some of that is to do with ChatGPT, because ChatGPT was made in the public domain in November of last year. And it has developed what are called emergent properties. That's to say, the people who developed it did not predict that it would be able to do some of the things that it's already able to do. In other words, you know, it's outperformed. It's doing things it was never programmed to do. And if ChatGPT in its current incarnation can do that, then we have to think very seriously about whether and how we license companies to produce more sophisticated large language models such as ChatGPT, because they have the ability already to threaten our jobs. They have the ability to threaten our freedoms. There's great benefits. Okay, we can cure cancer. We can solve global warming, climate change.
We can explore, as we were talking earlier, we can explore Mars. And I guess just as we wrap this up now, Fevzi, and I'm glad we've had this conversation, I'm not saying, please don't think that I'm against this stuff, but I think there is a question to be asked, and I think we should be asking it. And the question is very simply, yes, we want this, but how much of this do we want?
Yeah. What you need is a government that's going to introduce a licensing scheme. Certain types of AI development should be banned. We need international treaties in the way that we have them for nuclear proliferation. Because, you know, although we're not friends with China at the moment, China doesn't want to lose control of its country either. So we have something in common. This is more like, if you imagine we were invaded by aliens from another world, and in like an Independence Day, all the countries... Yeah,
hopefully
the world
between 10
together.
And midnight on a Sunday night, yes.
So the way that countries would all pull together, you know, and our differences as nation states would disappear because we were being attacked by an external force. In the same way, we should recognise the existential and other threats posed by AI, and we need to actually come together and have treaties that are verifiable.
Yep, Fevzi, we've got to park it there. Thank you very much. Glad we had that conversation. I know it's a bit of a heavy topic, but it's a relevant one because it's going to materially affect the lives of each and every one of us. And, you know, I like to have a laugh. You know, part of my career was doing news. I've also played records and had fun on the radio. I've done loads of stuff. This, I think, is a serious topic that we need to just stop for a minute and think about. That's all. You know, enjoy the benefits of it. But please, before you enter into this brave new world, consider what it means. All I say.